This is Rock and Roll Grad School with your hosts, Heidi Hedquist and Luke Poling. This ain't no nightclub or CBGBs.
They were planning to tour this fall.
Right. You've been severely depressed for years.
Right. And I don't blame her in the least.
Nope. I don't either.
Yeah. And we are not country stars.
We are not.
Yet. Yes.
We should put that on the list because it'd be the last thing we would pursue. But
yeah,
we
that's very, very true.
Mm-hmm. I could grow my hair out like Crystal Gayle.
Oh, there you go. Because that'll make your brown eyes blue, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Hello, kitties. We're going to have a good time together.
Yes.
Because we found our thrill in Beverly Hills.
We did indeed.
Yes. And we can just pretend that you're broadcasting from
Beverly Hills.
Yeah, Rodeo Drive or something like that.
Sure, why not?
We are talking with the authors of...
I mean, that's where... Sorry.
What? No, go, please. Just go.
Where I want to be.
Exactly. Oh, very good. Very nice. Yes.
Thank you.
We're talking today with the authors of A Pig's Tale, a great book about the history of the trademark of quality record company, I guess we could say.
And this is part two. We should probably
preface
that because we don't want people to think this is a rerun. This is not. We don't do reruns.
No, we don't. This is part two. The first half was on our sister show, Why, available wherever you get your podcasts. And this is part two that goes into a little more depth on some of the stuff, more musically based than not. Stagecoach. Are you familiar with this?
As in the movie?
No.
As in
yes, exactly.
Getting held up while traveling through the Old West?
Miss Kitty's? No. The Country Music Festival.
Oh, vaguely.
Okay. So I guess we could say a friend of a friend, Margot Price, rode in on a horse. And this year, the good folks at Stagecoach finally put their foot down. I don't know if you saw this. Mm-mm. No Confederate flags.
Wow.
To which you kind of want to be like, how has this not been a thing before?
Yeah, one would wonder. Yeah.
So
where does said event take place?
California.
Well, that's very odd.
I believe it is the same grounds as Coachella, and isn't there another one that's in that same area? It's not Burning Man, but
no, but yeah, okay.
So that's desert.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Like if it was in Alabama, I could see them being late to the party, but California,
right.
I would have thought they would have
exactly
made that decision a while back.
Yeah. Well, so thank God Coachella is already over. So that way you don't have to worry about whether or not to pack your Confederate flag.
True.
Past. So
Confederate flag bikini.
Save it for Burning Man, I guess. And then burn it at Burning Man. Yeah, that's what you can do.
This makes sense. This is a good plan, actually.
Yes. We were talking about it before you came on, saying that it is a doorstop of a book, and in the best way possible.
I hope people don't just use it as a doorstop.
No.
And that's a sign of love coming from us. Like we love these big, hearty books that have to take a place of honor in your home because the information is so good and the conversation piece.
Thank you. Exquisite.
So what made the two of you decide to write this book and decide to write this book now? It's a huge undertaking.
Yeah, it's just had been, you know, it had been so long now, 50 years since it began. And I just felt that the story just should have been told, really. I really wanted to tell this story because it was such an undertaking in the beginning, and it turned into a pretty wild ride that produced some great recordings and some great records. And we were thumbing our nose at the record companies, and I just felt the story needed to be told, because if we didn't do it, I don't think it ever would get told. So we just decided to uh, to get all the stuff together and connect with Pigman and get this story told and the discography made, where all the recordings were in order and everything, chronological order, and this is what transpired, and this is what came about with this book.
It's amazing, and it's and as you were saying briefly when you first came on, that's where it all began, but it's something that I think a lot of music fans, even generations beyond, who maybe were excited about the bootlegs of the 90s or things like that, don't have the history or understanding of how this world came to be and what a crazy story it is of how it came to be. So bringing it to everyone is just incredible.
Yeah, that's how we felt. Yeah, that's why we wanted to tell it, because back then, let's face it, 50 years ago is not what went on in the 90s or even now with right. bootlegs. It was completely different, and it was new to everyone, so it was almost like we were making it up as we went along, so to speak, because it had never been tried, and Pigman had this had never been done. So this is what made it exciting. And
well, and to just have that experience as a fan, to write as it was first happening, to have access to that had to just be the craziest feeling to live that from the fan side too.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because, and obviously if it wasn't for the music and our love of, of rock and roll and the artists this would be nothing. It wouldn't be fun. It wouldn't have been, exciting, because, taking a chance and doing stuff like that for the first time that nobody had ever attempted to do before. So
now I noticed, Harold, you used the term "we" a few times. It pops up in the book where it's we were part of this thing. How open do you want to be about your role in all of this? Because clearly there is some connections to this world. Yeah.
We met Pigman years ago and he took a liking to me, and I, same here, and we became friends, and I helped out a few times. I didn't have a major role, but I was there for several different things. That was really my involvement. I have no problem talking about that. But I was just there during the whole thing as it was unfolding, not for necessarily every record we put out or they put out, but, but it was just fun time.
Do you think the overall, reputation of bootlegs has changed over the decades? Because what TMQ was putting out, one sort of forced artists to go back to their own labels and go back to their vaults and sort of go, well, people want these. You look at, Great White Wonder with the Basement Tapes. But also, recording history, like you said, Pigman recording the Stones tours, 72 being a completely different Stones than a few years later or a few years earlier, and getting this incredibly important document for people to study in future generations. Obviously, this was probably not the thought at the time, but, as somebody who was not there in 72, it's great to be able to hear this is what this band sounded like at, one of their many peaks of greatness.
Well, one thing that I think the bootlegs have done is it forced the record labels to open their vaults. It's a shame that they waited so long, because the first one to do this, of course, was Dylan in 1991, when he authorized Sony to release the first three volumes of the bootleg series. Now they're up to volume 17 or 18. And it's a shame that it's taken so long for all these other artists to open their vaults and release this stuff now, because, we're talking 40, 50 years now. I mean, even Neil Young, who hated bootlegs, has a bootleg series now.
Yeah, he just started that.
And doesn't the most recent archives box have I think at least one bootleg where he basically just took it back and re-released it under his own.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Like one of the one thing that came out was this Carnegie Hall concert. I mean, I think it's 1970. It's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And he even made the, I have the CD version. I'm sure the LP version looks the same. And the cover looks like a bootleg, which is funny to see.
Oh, and then you have Zappa doing the whole Beat the Boots boxes. And it seems like it really started the conversation and started the appreciation for some of this stuff in a way that the labels and maybe even the artists didn't get at the time.
Yeah, well, it took 25, like I said, 1991, from the end of TMQ in 76 to 1991 is 25 years. Right. And it took that long before somebody finally did it. And now you have all these archive series and bootleg series. And, you know, I think it's wonderful this stuff's finally surfacing. But the problem is, you know, the younger generation, you know, wasn't there and didn't realize the impact of the early bootlegs, not just TMQ, but there was a lot of them that were just fantastic. So I just hate to see that the bootleg, all this archive series and bootleg series, the legitimate ones that are being released by the various major labels are just, you know, for the older collectors.
Right. Mm. Do you, both of you, I'll just start with Harold, have a favorite TMQ release that is just for you, one of your favorite records?
Yeah, I mean, I could name probably a few, but the one that really stands out that I used to play to death was Liver Than You'll Ever Be, you know, the Stones. It was just incredible. It was incredible. And the reaction it got in the business and the write-ups it got in Rolling Stone and in Newsweek and various publications. Rolling Stone said it was the ultimate, you know, Stones live album at that point. Because this was 8 or 9 months before they released Get Your Ya-Ya's Out. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, what forced Decca and London to rush that thing out, even though to me it wasn't as good as Liver. Liver just had a raw edge to it. And it was just one of my favorites. One of my, you know, one of the best ones.
So. Ralph, any standout for you?
Well, my sentimental favorite is Great White Wonder, the first, even though it's definitely not a sound spectacular, but Liver, Than You'll Ever Be, the Stones, and I'm quite fond of the Beatles Vancouver from 1964, which those original tapes from the actual stage were discovered by Pigman in Vancouver, British Columbia, at a radio station. And to discover something like that and then release it, I thought was very special.
Yeah, that's a gift from the gods right there. Like how?
And the first Frank Zappa Hot Rats at the Olympic Auditorium. And the Bright Lights Big City, which were Rolling Stones radio broadcasts. I mean, that stuff is just unbelievable. I mean, now, of course, they've released a BBC Rolling Stones. I have a hunch that they got some of those tracks from bootlegs because a lot of those BBC tapes don't exist, the masters, because the BBC used to record over and reuse the tape. So they didn't keep those tapes. And a lot of the BBC stuff that's come out legitimately, the Beatles and Stones, that stuff had to come from bootlegs. It wouldn't exist without bootleggers.
That's like the greatest irony right there, especially the BBC of all places. Yeah.
Well, BBC, they kept all the masters of classical recordings, but not pop recordings.
Right.
They erased all the pop stuff right away. Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's why when you hear those, the quality varies so much on them.
Yeah.
The ones that you hear now.
It was the Beatles at the BBC. Yeah. Same thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I've heard Pigman say in interviews that he wishes he kept some copies of these records, that fiscally he'd be probably better off. What was his reaction to this? Because you can somewhat easily figure out who he is and find him online. what is his, you know, clear, and he's happy with being part of this world. What was his reaction to the book, and how does he feel about all this?
Well, from what we've been told, he was happy with the results of the book, but he was very nervous about going public with this thing after all this time. He's still totally paranoid, of course.
It'd be hard not to be.
As was his partner, Carl, so.
Do you think that'll ever change? Or do you think it'll go to the grave with them?
I doubt it.
Yeah.
Does he kind of realize his role in all of this and sort of the, like we were talking, the historical and the importance of what he and what you guys were doing?
Oh, I think so. But I don't think he's not an egomaniac or anything. He enjoyed the time, but, you know, he's gone on with his life doing other things. So.
Yeah.
I think it's been gratifying seeing that there's so much attention in the world still to TMQ and what happened then, you know, the early albums. I think that's pretty much amazed everybody. How much, if you go online, it's just astounding how many people are still interested in the early bootlegs and Trademark Equality.
Yeah, it's had such a lasting effect 50 years later still.
I was amazed. I was looking at a website the other day, a Rolling Stones bootleg site, and they listed over 4,300 titles.
That's insane.
That's a lot.
Holy shit. I can't believe it.
Wow.
That's a lot of satisfaction to just be in one room surrounded.
And right at the top of the home page, the first thing you see up there is the Trademark Equality logo.
Of course.
One, I feel too, like getting into trading of recordings and listening to stuff online. So many years later, I started this sort of my own journey, late 90s, early 2000. And that's 25, 30 years past TMQ's reign, but still Liver Than You'll Ever Be, Great White Wonder. Those titles are still ubiquitous. And that's what everybody holds as this gold standard to this is a great recording.
Well, they were the first of their genre. I mentioned in the book that there were bootleggers going all the way back to the early days of recording, you know, the late 19th century, early 20th century. And the first bootleg artist was Caruso in the early 1900s. There were people making bootleg 78s of Caruso. He was the first superstar, and he was the first one to be bootlegged. And Dylan and the Stones, it was a new era of pop artists, but there had been bootlegs all the way through of jazz people and classical and opera that had always gone on. But no one had bootlegged a major pop artist before. That was the big difference in 1969 when Great White Wonder came out.
But even though they were the first of the pop artists, kind of to Luke's point, they still hold up, not just because they were the first, but because they're that exquisite.
Well, it's who they were. I mean, Bob Dylan and the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, I mean, they were the great talents of their era.
But there could have been some pretty crappy recordings out there, bootlegs out there, if they hadn't been done right.
Are you talking about sound?
Everything, every aspect of it. The fact that they're still the ones that everyone still talking about all these years later wasn't just because they were the first. It was the artist. It was the quality. It was all of it that they've stood the test of time.
Well, I recently got one of the bootleg sets of Dylan, and there was a session done with George Harrison on there. Mm-hmm. Where they were working in the studio or playing around. And that had been a legendary recording. Everybody wanted to have a bootleg of that, but it never leaked out before. And I listened to it. It was just awful. I mean, it was just awful. And I thought, no wonder, you know, it wasn't released, but I was, you know, this legendary recording that you think would be this great masterpiece. And it was just them, you know, wanking around in the studio and nothing came of it. But so not everything unreleased is of good quality, of course. Right. That's my point.
True.
Yeah. Has the overall, the availability of music recently, it's, you can go find a show 24 hours after, you know, the band steps off stage pretty much.
Sure.
Has that changed, do you think, the appreciation of what that entire transaction that's taking place to record something?
Oh,
to
post sure. It? Because it's everywhere now. I mean, it's not, there's so much stuff now. It's not as special because in the beginning, because the limitations of technology of the time, you know, to have an unreleased Bob Dylan track or to have a live recording of the Rolling Stones, that was very special. And now it's just everywhere. So good luck trying to collect everything now if you're a hardcore collector. I mean, people to hold their phone up, you know, at a Stones concert, you know, and within a few hours, it's gone viral. But it's not as special anymore. The trademark of quality was of an era.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a time. That's one of the points of the book. It was a time and place. It couldn't have happened in a different time in history or in a different place. It happened. It was just everything came together at that one moment in that one place. And what happened, if you read in the prologue to the book, it was what had come before in the 1960s that made Great White Wonder possible.
Yeah.
You know, the drug culture, the anti-war culture, just the whole movement in the 60s, the youth movement, is what made it all possible. I mean, there wouldn't have been an audience for a Great White Wonder or Liver had all that not happened. And that's one of the points that I wanted to make in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very special.
To give it a historical context. It's not just about, you know, some rock and roll music and a bunch of crazy collectors.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, much more than that. Much more than that.
And that comes through. It definitely comes through.
Well, that's what we were trying to put across in the book. Yeah. But we filled the book with a lot of stuff for the collectors, you know, pictures. And one of the things that really impressed me was how Genius Books not only backed the project, but they said, oh, we're going to do everything in color. And when they said that, my mouth fell open.
I said,
I want to have pictures of the albums, you know, of the album covers and the records and the labels and the tape boxes, that kind of thing. And they said, okay, we'll do everything in color.
Yeah, because a lot of the colored vinyl too just really stands out.
Right. You
know, nobody was
sure. And those pictures of the colored vinyl, the way we did that was we actually photographed the records. We laid them on a piece of white Lucite plastic and we lit them from behind and took the pictures from above. So they were lit from the back. And that's why the pictures, the color of the records are so luminous in the book. We went to a lot of trouble and we had to camp out on Pigman's Island to get all that done.
Yeah, to just really make it pop, you know, we just had to do that.
He wasn't going to let those records leave the archives. So we had to do all that on site to get everything.
Makes
sense. Well, it's a great book, and it's one of the few I think that I found that is, like you said, sort of a perfect record of everything that came out on this one label, and it's so well organized and recorded, but then it also on top of that has a fascinating story and just looks great and is really fun to just pick up and thumb through. So it's a really, really great book. we both really enjoyed it. I keep holding up my physical copy and Heidi's very jealous. So
I am very jealous. I'm about to order my physical copy, but I had to, I was still, I felt so blessed to be able to read it prior to speaking to you at all, but I had to read the digital version and Luke's got his beautiful hard copy and he always is pulling it out and I'm like, oh, okay. So
well, one thing I just want to add about the book. The book has three elements. It's got the story, and then it's got the pictures,
right?
You know, photographs from the time. It's got reproductions of the records, the tape boxes as you're holding up.
Yeah.
And then the other part is the information, which is on the information documents, the grids in there. So you have three different elements. And then in the back, which was one of the I'm one of the things I'm most proud of is actually recreating the original TMQ catalog, numerical catalog, complete with all the titles and numbers. I mean, no one's ever seen that before.
Yeah. It's
and that was a lot of work tracking down all that stuff to figure out, you know, what were the original TMQ albums.
Yeah. That's
I can imagine.
That's the thing, like collector's dream. The detail, again, it's just astonishing.
Yes.
Yes, well, it is.
Thank you both so much for your time. Yes. It's really great to talk to you. We clearly, as you can tell, enjoyed the book.
Well, I'm a talk about the Midnight Rambler.
Pig's Tale, the underground story of the legendary bootleg record label, is available right now from Genius Book Publishing. You can check out their website, geniusbookpublishing.com, or for more information, you can go to the website they've set up for the book, that is tmqapigstale.com.
You can check us out on all the various socials. Be sure to visit our website at rockandrollgradschool.com, and don't forget to leave us a review.
Today's show is produced by myself and Heidi Hegquist. Our reluctant producers are John Survey and Sandy Stone. Our willing producers are Rachel Allen and Randy Jeanette. Our intern is Zach Jackson. This one's for Philippe. Thank you, good night, and may all your favorite bands stay together.